Meeting to order. Good morning, everyone. I think we know who's here, so please note the attendance. Anybody willing to approve the minutes?
So moved.
Representative Hillstrom moves the minutes. Thank you. Questions to the minutes? Seeing none, all in favor, say aye.
Aye.
Those opposed? Minutes adopted. Mr. Hansen, is this that fancy committee with all those questions you get to answer, or is this a different committee?
Same room, I think different cast of characters. Well, it's Senator Olson. I think Senator Scheid is on the LCPFP, aren't you?
I'm not.
Aren't you? Is that the one I bought that I don't go to?
Well, I've seen all of you somewhere.
Yes.
So, at some committees. Thank you.
Good morning,
Mr.
Commissioner.
Chairman.
Please go ahead when you're ready, sir.
Members, thank you for the opportunity to meet with you today. And at my right is Nathan Morocco, our director of our CGIP program. We're here today bringing you three of the negotiated labor contracts and two of our pay plans for unrepresented employees. As you know, our labor agreements run concurrent with the state's fiscal year, and these contracts were set to expire on June 30th of this year, which is tomorrow. So we are bringing to you the AFSCME contract, the MAPE contract, the middle-level manager's contract, Mr. Chairman, and then the commissioner and the manager's plan. This was an unusual round of bargaining in that we reached a voluntary settlement with our two largest unions in April and following through with our supervisory unit in May. It's been quite a while. In fact, I can't remember when it was done that early. It was at the request of the it was initiated by labor in an effort to avoid any controversies or distractions with the budget deficit. And it was an example of it was a difficult round of negotiating between labor and management, but in the end, their differences were solved. And for those, and these three contracts should be complimented for their ability to work out their differences. In general terms, we're pleased, the state's pleased with the settlements, considering the budget shortfall, our requirement under the law to bargain in good faith, and our workforce development responsibilities. As I said, I have Mr. Morocco with me. He'll talk about the CGIP program, and Paul Larson, our state negotiator, will also be up a little later to talk about the contracts. Mr. Morocco will provide you an overview of the 2010 and 11 insurance years, and Mr. Larson will be presenting you with the details of the MMB negotiated labor agreements and pay plans. And we welcome questions at any time, Mr. Chairman, but I will at this point like to turn it over to Mr. Morocco.
Thank you, Commissioner. Thank you, Mr. Morocco.
Thank you, Mr. Chair and members of the committees. For the record, my name is Nathan Morocco. I'm the director of the Employee Insurance Division at the Minnesota Management and Budget. As Commissioner Hansen indicated, I'll just do a quick run-through on the insurance program for the 2010 and 2011 year. Feel free to ask any questions as we go along the way. Just as a reminder, we run the program on a calendar year basis, so you may see some differences between the fiscal year numbers and the calendar year numbers. So I just wanted to point that out. So with that, hopefully all of you have the handout. I'll just start on page 2. I won't go into a lot of details on the trend analysis that we do for our program, but this is something that we worked with very closely with the unions on this year to really go through the methodology that we have for assessing what is going on with the CGIP insurance program, as well as what's going on with the industry trends as a whole. Largely where we've ended up for the program are assumptions that for the 2009 plan year, we will have an 8% trend. For 10, we will have an 8.4% trend. And for 2011, we will have an 8.5% trend. So essentially for us then, that's the starting point in terms of what we need to either bargain in terms of premium increases, plan design changes, or any other means that we have at our disposal to ensure that we are able to accommodate these trend increases for the program. What that amounts to in terms of overall dollars for the program, if you turn to page 3, I have circled, and there's a lot of detail on here, but again, I'm trying to keep this very brief. The $84 million is the total dollar amounts for the next 2 years that those trend increases translate into. So that's the starting point for the labor negotiators as we enter into the bargaining process. We need to find a way to come up with $84 million. Okay? With that, if you'll turn to page 4, I'll cover some of the summaries, plan design changes for you. I think Mr. Larson will talk about the specifics of the bargaining process and why we ended up with the plan design that we did. But in essence, we ended up really with very little changes in the program for 2010-2011. For 2010, we will have no plan design changes, and in 2011, there will be no plan design changes. In essence, that means all co-pays, co-insurances, out-of-pocket maximums, all of that stays the same. For 2010, we will also have zero change in premium, both in terms of the premium increase and the premium cost sharing. As a refresher, we have employees who work full-time have 100% paid single coverage. Those employees with family coverage pay 15% of the premium, and the state picks up the other 85%. So all of that remains unchanged for the 2010 and 2011 plan year. We are projecting for 2011 a 6.7% increase in the premium. I say projection because that is our estimates as of this time. However, a year from now, we will meet and confer with the unions. We will update the financials of the program, and then we will make adjustments accordingly up or down depending on the needs of the program. We have also committed to an additional $125 into an HRA in 2011 for all state employees. That would include yourselves as well. This is, again, this is very similar to what we had received this year, where we all received a $250 HRA, further rewarding the members for really being wise and conscientious consumers. The program still continues to trend very well, continues to trend better than the industry norm. We wanted to reward our members for that. We will look at some additional plan design features due to the bargaining, the unique bargaining process that we had this year. Normally, we would not be bargaining until June. We completed the bargaining in April. As such, there were certain things that we were all interested in talking through, and we had some ideas about what we would want to do around plan design. But given the time constraints, there's a host of things that we agreed to move to the off-season during the summer and from now until the next time that we bargain benefits. Some of those would include the concept of waiving any costs related to centers of excellence. That would be incenting our members to seek higher quality providers that can demonstrate better outcomes for our members, as well as a cost savings to the program. The major changes that we had around clinics were that all the health partners clinics were moving down to level 1, which was something we were very excited about. And this is the last piece is not something we bargained, but was legislated back in 2008, that we would offer a consumer-driven health plan along with an HSA for all managerial and commissioner plan employees. In terms of dental, we will have no plan design increase. No plan design changes. For 2010 and 2011, we will have a decrease in premiums of 2% on the dental. However, there is a $5 minimum premium, so for singles, it probably will remain at the $5. And we are estimating an increase on the dental side of about 4%. With that, then, I will take you to page 5. Hopefully, this is a document that you have seen, or if you haven't, is something that we will be issuing from the program on a twice a year basis. This is really the financials of the program. Everything that we spend within the program is listed here on this page. I won't go into all the details. It's something, if you're interested in, I would be happy to meet with anyone and go over the specifics. But I will point out a couple key pieces on here, and those are the items that are circled. The first one would be in the 2012 forecasting. While we were able to keep plan design flat, while we were able to keep premiums relatively low, the reason we were able to do that is that the plan has been performing better than expected. The result of that has been that there has been additional dollars in the program that were not needed. those dollars were directed back into the program. Okay, so essentially, if you recall early in my presentation, I talked about roughly 8% trends in medical costs. Okay, but we have premiums of 0% for 2010. The way we were able to do that is to take those extra dollars and artificially subsidize the premium. Okay, the important piece about that is that those are one-time dollars. That those are dollars that we have today, but it's not based on any revenue stream that we have. So it's a one-time impact to the program. So what that means for 2012 is that we will no longer have those dollars. And so while this year during this round we were looking for roughly $85 million, next round we'll be looking for roughly $115 to $120 million without any reserve to help mitigate those increases. So what that means for 2012 is that we will be looking at increases of around 16.5%. Okay, that's very significant for us. So while things look very good for the next 2 years, we will have a challenge 2 years from now as we meet with the unions and we meet with you folks and we talk about how we're going to mitigate this 16%. Are we going to increase the cost sharing with members? Are we going to increase co-pays and deductibles? These are all ways that we can use to affect that 16.5%, but it will be there and it will be a challenge for us.
Senator Olson.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. Mr. Morocco, what kind of assumptions, maybe I missed it if you said it, the performance has been better, which has allowed for the reserve that will cover and mitigate any premium increase. Are you assuming going forward that we're not going to have that continued performance, or what are your assumptions related to that drive the 16.5% increase?
Mr. Morocco.
Mr. Chair and Senator Olson, we do take into account that there will be some continued gains in the program. However, our feeling is that most of the gains are one time. It's a little bit difficult for us to know whether or not we can expect this year over year. But I think typically if you work with benefit consultants, they would say that once you implement a program and you achieve those gains, you will then trend on a typical trend. So while your trend line might start lower, it will increase at the same rate prior to implementing any kind of prevention program or health improvement program. What we've seen is that we have actually been able to not only lower the trend but actually bend the trend a little bit. And so when we look at trend information, we look at our own trend. We also ask the health plans for their analysis of the trend for our program, and we also ask for their analysis on healthcare trends in general. And so through a weighting process, we take those three assumptions, we blend them together, and that's how we come up with our aggregate trend for the program. But it is probably one of the biggest challenges for us is to try and assess whether or not we will continue to bend that curve or if we will start to trend upward like most other programs do.
Senator Olson, any further?
Oh, Mr. Chair, there was one other question I had. Is the HRA the HSA?
Mr. Morocco.
Mr. Chair and Senator Olson, no, that's actually independent. So everyone will receive the $125 HRA, all state employees.
What does that stand for?
The HRA would be a health reimbursement arrangement. So it's essentially its employer contribution dollars into account. Hopefully you are all familiar with the debit card, hopefully that you're received and are using. So that card is loaded currently with $250 is what you received this year. In 2011, you'll receive an additional $125. The HSA is actually for managerial and commissioner plan employees only. Okay. So it's only about we're estimating about 3,000 to 5,000 employees. And that account is really independent of the 125. It'll be a completely independent program. It'll be separate in terms of premium plan design. And what the actual HSA contribution would be has yet to be determined.
So Mr. Chair, this would augment the health, the pre-tax benefit.
Mr. Morocco.
I'm sorry, Mr. Chair. Senator Olson, can you repeat the question?
Mr. Chair and Mr. Morocco, so the 125 is like the 250, which essentially augments whatever you put aside for pre-tax benefits.
Mr. Chair, Senator Wilson, yes, that would be correct. You can actually use, in theory, if you're a managerial or commissioner plan employee, you could have the FSA, the HRA, and the HSA all working in concert together.
Okay, thank you.
Representative Bingham.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. Maybe I'm not going to be articulating this the right way, but if there was this pot of money because of good performance to keep the premiums low, was it possible or ever a consideration to amortize that over a few years, I guess to kind of stretch it out versus just dumping it in at 1 year?
Mr. Morocco.
Mr. Chair and Representative Bingham, yes, actually, that was strongly considered. The message back to us from the unions was that they wanted to mitigate all costs as soon as we could. And so we essentially took those dollars and we spent them as fast as we could within the next biennium. We could have taken those dollars and perhaps spent half of it this biennium, half of it in year 3 and 4, and that would have mitigated that 16.5% increase. So perhaps we could have ended up with, 5% increases over the next 5 years rather than very low increases in the first 2 years and potentially high increases in the second two. But those were all things that were considered, and all things this document actually was presented and worked through with the unions extensively, so they understood, the financials and the impact of spending more sooner rather than your suggestion, Representative, of perhaps trying to spread it out over multiple years.
Mr. Chairman, Representative Bingham, I think you're articulating what would have been a preference of ours, but in looking at the what happened with the Advantage Plan, you also have to keep in mind that the on the compensation portion of the contract, employees did not receive the cost of living increase in either year, no steps in the first year. So in the context of bargaining, the CGIP account, which had the significant surplus, this was a way to mitigate those lack of increases.
Right.
Representative Bingham.
Thank you, which seems the logical thing if they're not getting a raise to keep the health care costs down. The other question I have is what other ideas or what do you see coming forth as far as maybe some plans to mitigate the 16.5%? I know this is an estimate, a forecast, and we may be performing better where premiums may come down a little bit, but is there anything in the immediate future that you're going to be doing to see if that estimate would come down a little bit?
Mr. Morocco.
Mr. Chair and Representative Bingham, I don't know that we have anything specific. We would be looking at relative cost-sharing arrangements, what is reasonable for the state to be paying versus our members. Keeping co-pays flat essentially means that the state is picking up more of the cost of the program. So from just a cost-sharing perspective, I think we would be analyzing that. We do have several programs in the pipeline that we're very excited about that I think will continue to keep our trend lower. We have a medical therapy management program, which has doubled the effectiveness for diabetics. We have a depression program called the Diamond Project, which is a statewide project, which has shown excellent results around depression. We're also significantly impacted and involved in the healthcare reform that passed in 2008. So we're going to be looking at the Department of Health is charged with creating peer groupings around cost and quality that we will be implementing in 2010. We'll be involved again in a pay-for-performance program that Department of Health is responsible for creating, along with for DHS. We'll be implementing medical homes in 2010. So there's a lot of activity in the program that is actually a result of legislative work as opposed to bargaining that we'll be involved in that we're very hopeful will actually be changing the curve, not only for CGIP, but for the state as a whole.
Mr. Chairman, Representative Bingham, another area of, I think, disagreement between us and the unions is the size of the CGIP reserve, and they may have communicated that to you. The 16.5% increase in premiums that you see circled at the top of the one chart reflects the notion that, in our belief, our strong belief, that the CGIP reserve should remain at 16.7%. In the course of our discussions with the unions, there's I think they have advocated at times going a little lower, down to I think it is 12%. Mm-hmm. So that is as we go forward, you'll see, you know, especially I'm assuming in 2 years when this comes up again, that may become an increased issue.
Thank you.
We have done pretty well in this in Minnesota on keeping good strong reserves and not having it's. I don't ever remember us having to use general fund money to prop up the CGIP account. And actually, we try to make sure that the general fund doesn't take CGIP money to balance the budget.
Yeah. Senator Metzen.
Yeah, Mr. Morocco, I might be the only one in the building that got this red card and didn't know what the hell it was for.
You are.
Yeah. Am I?
No.
You know, and I got these two little red cards, and I thought, here we go, another credit card, you know. And I know you can't get a credit card without. Years ago, you could send them to people. Now you can't. But anybody else have that? HRE thinking like I do? I did. I understand now. I didn't burn them up. I didn't cut them up.
Sure.
But I got these things, and what the hell are they for? You know, and maybe there was something I was supposed to read.
Read your mail.
Yeah. Am I supposed to read my mail?
Yeah.
I'm guilty.
Did you try?
You shouldn't admit,
Mr. Morocco.
Mr. Chair and Senator Metzen.
Tell me there were more people that got these things.
There was more people.
Huh?
Yes, there were others as well.
A lot of others?
Some. Well, some.
35,000.
Yeah.
35,000 were like me, right?
Yeah. You have 34,999 others.
Yeah. Good. Thank you. I'll rip that thing off and call it number so you can access this thing. But.
Yeah, Senator Metzen, we've actually had tremendous positive feedback about those cards. So
that's not what I wanted to hear.
So hopefully you'll have an opportunity to take advantage of it. So,
well, Mr. Chairman, Senator Metzen, that $250 carries forward between calendar. You know, it doesn't, unlike the pre-tax account that you lose at the end of a calendar year.
So it doesn't go away,
no,
Mr. Chairman.
No, it doesn't. So if you never figured it out till the end of December, you would still.
I've got it figured out now.
You do.
I didn't for a couple of months, but, but this is good. We could add 125 to it also.
And the same occurs with the $125.
Can we see a show of hands? Anybody else in the audience didn't know what the hell that thing was? Good, there's one. Thank you.
All right. I'm not sure where we're at.
Okay.
Mr. Morocco.
All right. Thank you, Mr. Chair. Just a couple more quick comments then. So the other circle is essentially identifying that the reserves beyond what Mr. Hansen, Commissioner Hansen had mentioned, the reserves are essentially zero beyond the two-month requirement. In terms of some of the other non-medical programs, then, I'll just cover these real quickly. No changes in terms of the accidental death and dismemberment or optional life. We will allow folks to increase their life insurance plan. That is the grid that's in the middle of page 6. There will be a rate reduction for those folks who choose to enroll in Child Life. We will have no increases in the short-term disability. We actually have done quite well in the long-term disability, and this really does go hand-in-hand. As your medical claims and experience goes down, you would expect to see a very similar pattern in your long-term disability, which we have. And so we'll actually be decreasing the premiums. Starting this next pay period, we'll decrease the premiums 10%, and we're also going to be refunding some dollars back to employees who have been participating in the long-term disability program from January through June of this year. We will be refunding premiums. Just as a reminder, short-term disability and most of long-term disability premiums are all employee paid, with the very few exceptions of those folks who enroll in a very special program in the managerial plan. There is some employer dollars there. Otherwise, for the most part, it's all employee dollars.
Mr. Chairman?
Senator Scheid.
Mr. Chairman, thank you. Mr. Morocco, just on that short-term and long-term disability, I went back and forth with the benefits person over the years. It strikes me, I don't see a reason for legislators to be in that. Can you tell me how that would work if a legislator, since we get paid through the end of our term, I guess, you know, I mean, unless we die before, but, I mean, we get paid. How would the disability work? It just... confuses my mind. I've had it, and then I haven't had it. I have no idea. I don't think I have it anymore because I thought, why am I doing this? I can't show any loss of income. If I mean, I haven't had a long or short-term disability, but...
Mr. Morocco.
Mr. Chair and Senator Scheid, I'm not sure if I understand the question exactly. Is it on the presumption that legislators earn a salary regardless of?
Yes.
Okay. Yeah. And so if you were to become disabled, you would still continue to receive that salary?
Mm-hmm. She could not show up at all for the rest of her term and be totally disabled and still receive her salary. So why then does she?
I'm not planning on that.
No,
but, you know, but I don't think
yes.
or counting on it in any way, shape, or form. But
there's provision. Yeah.
I just wondered.
I think that's an excellent question. I would want to if I could get back to you on that. Mm-hmm. I would like to do that. I think that's an excellent question.
Because I've got
Senator Scheid.
Mr. Chairman, I've gotten mixed responses, but usually they say, "Oh no, you'd qualify." Well, I don't see how. So if and that would be true. You know, for the governor or, you know,
yeah.
all I mean, the constitutional like officers.
I mean, certainly these benefits will carry beyond even your employment. So, I mean, I know that there would be some situations where, as an example, let's say you chose not to run again, but you would incurred an illness or a disability prior to separating, these payments would continue beyond that point. So there would be instances where... you know, where it would pay. But I'd like to think about if there's any other specific circumstances. Of course, long-term disability could very well carry beyond, you know, beyond any senator or representative's term.
Senator
well, that's
Scheid.
Interesting, Mr. Chairman, because if you lost your election, I just don't see how it could. I mean, I guess if you lose, you still are eligible to pay.
You would, yes.
You're still eligible to pay into it.
It's based on when the incident occurred. If you were actively engaged in the program, then that benefit would pay out regardless of your employment status after that.
Thank you.
Chairman.
Senator Metzen.
Mr. Morocco, on the LTC stuff, what does the state, if anything, do they help? Do they pay into that for long-term care?
Mr. Morocco.
Mr. Chair and Senator Metzen, no, they do not. What we're able to offer is a group rate, a community-based rated program. So much like our other programs, we're able to pool a lot of people together and get, I think, a better rate and a more stable rate. But beyond that, as an employer, no, they're not contributing. The other thing to keep in mind is that long-term care is also available for your parents. It goes beyond just employment as well. And if you were to leave the state, this program is completely portable, unlike, say, our medical plan, which is unless you're continuing through COBRA, you will no longer have access to it. So the long-term care is really intended to really be a product that you own as an employee. We try to, you know, provide you good access, reasonable rates, and then the portability.
Mr. Chairman.
Senator Metzen.
What do other states do in this area? Do they, that they're, you know, if you don't pay this privately or get some help, the taxpayers at the end of the day are going to be paying $80,000, $90,000 per person. There's got to be a better way for the state to encourage. I take it out, and on my tax returns, I think I get $100 back, which is nothing for what I pay in. And, again, if you could multiply people like me times thousands, that would go on the rolls. Not me, because I'm paying it. But we've got to find a way, I would think, to at least on the tax end encourage maybe up that 100 to 1,000 or something. And I know it all costs money, but that incentive would save the state millions and millions a year when the baby boomers and others are going to say to the government, you know, it's nice to hang around, but somebody else got to pay, not me. So just a thought that how do we encourage people to take out this kind of stuff? So I just a thought. Everything costs money, but instead of the $80,000, $90,000 a year at the nursing home to pay for medicine, you know, I'm paying my own way. But we've got to figure out a way to incentivize people to take out this kind of product. other than say it come out into our group, that's a little cheaper, but my God, you still have to pay 100%. So just, we got to start dreaming about that, I think. Sure.
Mr. Morocco.
Yeah, Mr. Chair and Senator Metzen, actually the state of Minnesota, I'm not an expert in this area. It's actually run out of DHS, but I think we're one of 14 states that is able to offer a partnership long-term care program, that which is essentially a state-federal created program that encourages people to enroll in long-term care by allowing them to hold on to more of their assets. And that's one of the reasons why we want to have an open enrollment within the next 2 years. These programs have only been available for a year or two. They're very new. The Department of Commerce has actually just certified our vendor to be able to offer these within the state. So as an employer, we're going to have a huge push in terms of long-term care. We actually have probably one of the highest enrollment rates in long-term care of any employer that I'm aware of. We're around 19%. Most employers would be lucky to get double digits. So, but certainly your point is well taken, and I would be happy to, if you want more information or if the committee wants more information, we could certainly get someone from the Department of Human Services who specializes in the long-term care area and the partnership program. We could certainly make that available, and I could make that connection for you.
The good news, Mr. Chairman, is that
Senator Metzen,
there is a plan. I mean, we could get into it, so that I compliment whoever... That's probably not good enough yet, but thank you for that.
Thank you.
Please continue, sir.
Okay. With that, then, I'll wrap it up in 30 seconds here on the last page, on page 7. So as I mentioned, there was a host of things that we were interested in talking about, the unions were very interested in, but given the time constraints that we had, there's a host of things we moved off to our off session. These will be things like who are our dependents. There are some dependent definitions that Department of Commerce has. They differ from what's in our bargaining agreements. So we're going to work on those differences in the off season. We're also going to look at how we can encourage our members to seek care. These might be systems that we put in place that would allow us to waive copays or lump copays together, so that if you have a series of events, perhaps there's only one copay for that series. There's a whole host of administrative complexities that go along with a proposal like that. And so these are things that we'll work on with our health plans and the unions in the off season. And finally, with our tier designation, our clinics are all designated either 1, 2, 3, or 4. We will be working with the unions. In fact, we have already met with them once, and we'll be finalizing the clinic assignments probably within the next 2-3 weeks. So with that, I'll make myself available for questions, and thank you for the opportunity.
Thank you, sir.
Mr. Chairman, same question. Mr. Chairman.
Senator Scheidt.
I just wanted to ask Mr. Morocco, could you just differentiate what those tiers mean? I've forgotten. I know that we've gone over it before, but
Mr. Morocco,
saying health partners going to level or tier one.
Yeah, so Mr. Chair and Senator Scheidt, essentially tier one would be the most cost-effective, high-quality providers. Tier four would be the highest-cost, lower-quality providers.
Representative Drazkowski.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. Mr. Morocco, help me if you will. I'm new to the committee, and I have to apologize. I was in Canada fishing last week, so we did eat good, though.
How did you do?
Very well. Very well. I'd recommend it to anyone. Under this plan, then, what is it going to cost taxpayers relative to the last contract?
Mr. Morocco.
Mr. Chair and Representative Drazkowski, actually, I think some of the other presenters will have the final numbers on the actual cost to the state. I don't know that I have that. If we could hold on that. Again, it's...
Some of the other presenters look...
Yes. Again, because this is all calendar year information, and this is for the entire state as a whole, which includes, the executive, judicial, legislative branches, quasi-state agencies like historical societies and boards, and the contracts that we're talking about specifically don't... this program is much broader than those contracts in particular. I also don't know all of the funding arrangements on some of those quasi-state agencies, what they choose to contribute and what they have their members contribute is something that's more proprietary to them than what we will be talking about today. So I wouldn't have those exact numbers.
Representative Drazkowski.
Just one more question, Mr. Chair. Thank you. So, Mr. Morocco, and I don't use the state red card, Senator, so I didn't have to figure it out. Is every state employee that uses the insurance program then, if they're on a single plan, it's 100% covered by the state, and a family is 85% covered by the state? Is that correct?
Yes, Mr. Chair.
Mr. Morocco.
Representative, yes, that is correct. From a premium perspective, however, there are some point-of-service costs as well. Individual members will contribute as they make their co-pays and their co-insurance payments to the program as well.
Mr. Chair, on that
just
point?
Representative Drazkowski.
Sorry, Senator, just a quick follow-up, and then I'm done, Mr. Chair. The future, then, is has that arrangement been a topic of discussion and negotiations at all? And I don't know anywhere else that this type of arrangement is available to anyone.
Mr. Morocco.
Mr. Chair and Representative, I think it would depend on the industry that you're looking at, whether you're looking at other public sector employers versus the private sector. I guess I couldn't comment on the specifics other than I think what I would say is by keeping the co-pays fixed, the state does become more liable or responsible for the overall total cost of the program, because as the liabilities of the program increase, a $20 copay is less in terms of a percentage of the program than it was the year prior. And so certainly I think if you would have seen our early proposals, it would have been to have more money on the table, a little bit more, at least keeping cost sharing consistent with what we've had in the prior 2 years.
Senator Olson.
Thank you, Mr. Chair and Mr. Morocco. The premium is paid, but is the variation come if you're on a one or a tier one or tier four clinic? Obviously, it's going to cost more. So is that adjusted for in the copays then, rather than in the underlying premium?
Mr. Morocco.
Mr. Chair and Senator Olson. Yes, when we set our premium, we are taking into consideration where everybody is within the tiering structure, but the tiers are designed in such a way that the incentives for the member are not in the premium, but are in the point of service costs. So if you go to a clinic one, your copay is going to be lower than if you go to a clinic four. Mm-hmm. However, what I would say about that is that folks who are in cost level four are somewhat subsidized by the rest of us who enroll in a one or a two. So in essence, yes, we differentiate the plan design, but it's not enough that actually it compensates for the actual increased cost to go to those three and four level clinics.
Okay. So Mr. Chairman,
Senator Olson,
you have in the past tried to do that through a sharing of premium up front, rather than just with the copays, but now because you take the range in consideration, technically the ones who are on tier one, you're paying more for, or it's credited with more premium up front than what is reality, given the level of efficiency they have. That's what you were saying. Okay.
Yes, Mr. Chair and Senator Olson, I think you put it a good way. Yes, if you look at it from an efficiency perspective, they will pay the same as somebody in a cost level four on the premium side, but will see their savings coming more on the point of service. So, I guess if there was somebody who didn't receive a lot of services, they aren't necessarily reaping the benefit of that cost level one.
Could I have one more question?
Of course.
Mr. Chair, Mr. Morocco, what kind of incentives do the providers have for improving their tier level?
Mr. Morocco.
I think I'm on a tier level two, and I was just wondering what approach I should use to them as to ask them why they're not tier one.
Sure. Mr. Chair and Senator Olson, their incentive is that the state is the largest employer in the state, and so we have a lot of bodies that we can send through anybody's door. And so if somebody has 500 state lives within their organization and they are currently a tier two, and we send them a letter that says they are becoming less efficient and they will be bumped up to a three or four, they risk losing those members. And so when we contact those providers, it's our greatest hope that they will call us and say, how can I get back down to a level two?
Okay.
And cost can be anything from just being inefficient in providing the care, perhaps providing too much care, overutilization or underutilization. It could just simply be a cost factor that they just pay more for their services or they charge more for their services. And so we give them that kind of breakdown so that they can understand what it would actually take to come down a level or two and get to, you know, wherever they want to be.
Okay.
That said, we don't always have a competitive advantage in every market, so it doesn't work everywhere. But mm-hmm. Where it does, it's very effective.
Okay. Thank you.
Ms. Morocco, are you...
I am done, yes.
You're done. Well, thank you very much for your presentation. Okay. You're going to stick around for...
I will stay here in case you have any okay. further questions.
Commissioner Hansen, here's...
I'm staying, but
you're staying. Okay, good.
Do it in Minsk now.
I'd like to, Larry. Ms. Larry.
Mr. Chair.
Representative Hillstrom.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. While we start moving into the individual plans, if I could actually have a couple of questions answered first. For example, which contracts are not yet settled, and then what the timeline and the status of those contracts are, so that before we get into the individual plans, we just kind of know the lay of the land.
Okay. Who?
Mr. Chair, Representative Hillstrom, the other contracts that have not been settled are those being negotiated by Minnesota Management and Budget, and when Mr. Larson is presenting his testimony, he can provide an update on those negotiations as well.
Okay.
Is that all right, Representative Fine. Hillstrom? Okay, thank you. Ms. Leary.
Yes, good morning. The contracts that are remaining for the Minnesota State Colleges and Universities are the two-year college faculty for the Minnesota State College faculty and the four-year Minnesota State University administrative and service faculty. First, I'll go through the MSCF contract. In essence, the only new provisions for this year is that we had no across-the-board increases in either year. We had no step increases in either year. A program that was begun in the last contract, that was the Awards for Excellence, is being held in abeyance. It's suspended for this FY11 contract. And the other provisions that continued were approved in the prior years. So we want to... acknowledge that the faculty stepped forward and we were very fortunate in not having any across the board or step increases during these tight fiscal times. If you would like, I can go through the other provisions that continued, but those are from the prior year's contract and were approved in the last biennium.
Is there a will for from the committee to hear the specifics? Otherwise, I'm pretty comfortable with going forward. Do you? Go ahead.
The net H number is minus 0.21. The net M number is 0.22%. So the fiscal impact is...
Where are you looking?
It's very positive.
So members will find that in...
That is in the last paragraph on the top of the second page, which summarizes settlement cost sheet.
Mr. Chair, I'm having a hard time hearing you. What are you referring to? I missed that...
In the summary, if you turn, first you have page 3 starts out the Minnesota State College faculty. If you turn to page 4, the top paragraph is the settlement cost sheet.
Okay.
And the net H number is a minus 0.21, and the net M number is a 0.22% going forward. What continues with these contracts is the cost of the health insurance that Mr. Morocco just covered.
Okay.
Just for members' sake, in the documents provided by staff, Mr. Hubinger's on the final page is kind of a spreadsheet, and that's kind of helpful, too, at least I find it to be.
Mm-hmm.
So please continue, Ms. Leary. Sorry.
Okay. Then the Minnesota State University Administrative and Service Faculty. The new provisions are that there were no across-the-board increases for FY 2010-2011, no step increases for 2010-2011, There is an increase in the maximum fiscal cap on honoraria to $1,000. It was previously $800. There's an increase in the professional development funds for the entire group from previously it was $315,000. It went up to $450,000. And we implement the same group health insurance. Language changes. We were able to obtain new language regarding an intermittent appointment and language regarding clarifying what the use of the professional development funds were to be used for activities which promote the goals and the mission of the member's department program or the university. In the summary, there is an error on the fiscal. If you go to the top of page 5, it says the net H number is a minus 0.7. That is correct. The net M number, however, is a minus 0.39, not just a 0.39. It's a minus 0.39. So we have cost reductions going forward. And those are the all of the new provisions of that contract.
Any questions for Ms. Leary? Representative Drazkowski.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. Ms. Leary, can you tell us what an H number and an M number is?
Ms. Leary.
Mr. Chair, Representative. The H number is the cost of the contract for this fiscal year. The M number is the cost of the contract for the next biennium. So it's the increased cost over the next biennium. The first one is the, I said fiscal year, this biennium. The next one is the following bienniums. That way you pick up any tails that may have been brought forward.
Thank you, Ms. Leary.
Thank you.
I guess that's it.
Mr. Larson.
Mr. Larson. Nice to see you back, Mr. Larson. It looks like you've gotten some sun. You're a little tanner than the last time we saw you in the end of session.
Yard work.
You've been after the list as well, huh? Go ahead when you're ready, sir.
Thank you. Mr. Chair, members of the commission, my name is Paul Larson. I'm the state negotiator, and I'm here today to bring before you the three labor agreements that are for your interim approval. The three labor agreements that are to be approved today are the AFSCME Council 5 agreement, the MAPE agreement, which is our professional employee unit, as the Middle Management Association as well. Subsequent to this, I will also be providing you with the explanation of the benefit changes in the commissioner's plan and manager's plan. Before I go into the details of the negotiated settlements, I think it would be helpful if I could provide the commission with some background information about what we as the state did in this round of bargaining. The bargaining process really starts a year before we actually meet face-to-face. It was last fall in 2008 that we began this process. We began by having focus groups with the agencies. We solicited information from the agencies on what was working, where we were having problems, and so on. And it's similar to the same process that labor goes through as well. But we all know, as the backdrop from last fall started with the housing collapse, the Wall Street scandals, and then the November forecast looming out there, it became eminently apparent that this round of bargaining was going to be a very difficult round of bargaining for us. We are required by law to negotiate with the labor unions, and that's the Public Employee Labor Relations Act, which is Minnesota Statutes 179A. And we knew that this was going to be a real daunting challenge. In about January, we actually set the bargaining dates. And typically what we do in the bargaining process is that the last week of June is where we try to reach the first tentative agreement with our two largest unions, and that's AFSCME and MAPE. And if this would have been the traditional round of bargaining, today we would have been probably at some Union Hotel or the Bureau of Mediation Services still trying to reach out a tentative agreement. And so we're very pleased that we're here early in this process. In addition to the negotiations with the specific unions, we also begin a process which we call coalition bargaining, which is where we sit down concurrently during the bargaining process with all of the labor unions to negotiate over the terms and conditions of the health insurance provision. This includes the faculty unions. It includes all of the other unions that have not settled or that are in the process. It includes the judicial branch as well. We ensure, in response to one of the questions, we have 50,000 employees that are insurance-eligible employees, and it covers about 120,000 lives. So as we begin the process and the give and take of the bargaining process, we also meet concurrently with all of the unions to talk about the insurance for the calendar year 2011 and 2012. After the November forecast came out and it became eminently apparent that we were certainly headed for a very difficult task in reaching these agreements, I would like to recognize the two large unions of AFSCME and MAPE that reached out to us and said that they did not want us to be a distraction in the budget process, and they requested that we accelerate the bargaining process and see if we could wrap this up earlier. I checked with Commissioner Hansen. I thought it was a good idea, and so that's what we did. So instead of being with the June 30th date, we met on April 17th with the two largest unions and worked for five continuous days. Some of those days were 24 hours. We also had the Bureau of Mediation Services there to provide us with assistance, and we did get a tentative agreement. A couple of points I'd like to share with you with regard to the coalition bargaining and in response to some of the questions that we have had earlier. The bargaining approach that I do as the negotiator representing the state's interest was that we concluded that with Mr. Morocco's numbers of about $87 million that we were going to have to find, I presented plan design changes and premium increases to actually capture all of that money. That's how I started out in the process. We proposed that singles pay $25. That would have captured about $30 million for us. And we also increased co-pays and plan design changes to capture that money. One of the other strategies that I have is that currently the cost-sharing relationship with our employees and the employer is that we pay 92% of the costs and the employees pay 8%, and I wanted to maintain that relationship. So those were the challenges and those were the goals that I had as I sat at the table. And, of course, you would expect that from labor's perspective, they had what I would call significant or measurable and responsible benefit improvements. And so that began the process. It seemed every week that the budget information was getting worse and worse, and everyone knew where we were headed from a pay point of view. It was in the last day of actually meeting with the coalition when labor acknowledged to us that they knew where we were going to land economically with regard to wages, and specifically made the request that we try our best to hold everyone harmless for the 2 years on insurance. That was a difficult decision, I think, because I do think that it does set us into some serious challenges next round, but presumably next round we'll be looking at some of those cost arrangements that we had in our initial proposal as well, and I think that they'll be prepared to face those challenges when we get to them. So having said that, we did reach a tentative agreement with AFSCME and MAPE on April 22nd, and the agreement did provide for no changes in insurance in either year in the plan design. It does provide for we are estimating that our premium increases in the second year will be 6.7%. We did spend the reserve money down, and it is, in my opinion, a reasonable compromise because we essentially have no across-the-board increases in either year of the contract for the employees. We did stop the steps in the first year of the contract, and it's a comment to be said about the step increases or performance increases, which we typically refer them as. Our employees in the MMB bargained units are hired and they're assigned to a salary range, and that salary range has approximately anywhere from 8 to 10 steps, and they vary from 2.5%, and some bargaining units our steps are 4%, and we place the employee at a step when we hire them, and the rationale on that is that each year, as they continue to perform satisfactorily and continue to learn and know more about the job, they can anticipate that they will get this performance increase every year, and it's typically on their anniversary date. And the anniversary date is the date that we hire them. And ultimately, you do get to the top of your pay scale, and that's where we consider to be at the performance level of that salary range that we've assigned you to. And so the steps in our labor agreements are built in to the contract. They're not date specific, and they've been in the agreement. This is my about 32nd year of negotiations, and these steps have been there all those years. So my challenge was get them out, and it's not very easy. It was a very daunting challenge, but I think on the other hand, labor had to realize the costs associated with those steps and the impact that that would have on the members that they were representing. And so the agreements that we have so far allow for the suspension of the first year step increases, but we do allow for a second year step increase to occur. So that would be in the last year of the collective bargaining agreement. And so in a nutshell, what you have is you have zero across the boards both years, no step increases in the first year, and then step eligibility in the second year of the agreement. And that's the agreement that we were able to get with AFSCME and MAPE, and subsequently for the Middle Management Association. I'll just give you a
Mr. Chairman?
Senator Olson.
Mr. Chairman, Mr. Larson, then the step increase is not automatic. It is based on performance evaluation.
Mr. Larson.
Mr. Chair, Senator Olson, that is correct. It's based, the labor agreements say that they're eligible to receive them based on satisfactory performance. So if you have someone that we have someone that we believe is not performing satisfactorily, we can withhold the step.
And Mr. Senator Chairman, Olson, what percentage is, do you have a ballpark figure of what percentage do achieve that step on an annual basis?
Representative Olson, approximately 98% of the people do get the step increases.
Mm-hmm. So, and Mr. Chairman, this may be premature, but probably for Commissioner Hansen, how much in terms of these agreements was in the budgets that were passed or are part of the consideration of any of the unallotments? Or is this going to mean, if none of it was budgeted, then does it mean that there's going to mean more layoffs? Or what are the consequences of the packages that we see before us?
Commissioner Hansen.
Mr. Chairman, Senator Olson, we have the budget bills that passed at the end of the legislative session, for the most part, have a 5% reduction in state agencies across the board. The governor's unallotment plan will implement an additional 2.25% for most agencies. So it'll be a total of 7.25% over the next 2 years. It'll be a combination of open, positions where people retire or leave, and we keep open. They'll probably, I don't have an exact amount, but it is over a two-year period. People leave through attrition. I don't know.
But Mr. Chair,
Senator Olson,
Mr. Chair and Commissioner, But was were those percentages applied to a base that factored in any increase, or was it were the assumptions that there would be a freeze or a flat cost to personnel?
Mr. Larson. Mr. Larson.
Representative Olson, the agencies were originally instructed to anticipate in their base projections a 3% increase of their base. And what that means is insurance, all costs associated. That means overtime. That means any wage driver that's costing in that. And so they projected that into their costs. And then as they were cut by their budget instructions, that money was then that they had projected in there was then correspondingly decreased as well. So I would say most agencies in projecting where that 3% was going to come from were factoring in retirements, they were factoring in layoffs, and so on. So there was no new money.
So Mr. General. Chairman and Mr. Larson, the fact that they factored, were they factoring in higher 3% when you're not having the percentage apply to more than 1 year, does that represent that they were factoring in a larger increase to begin with than what these contracts represent?
Mr. Larson.
You said 3% for everything. 3% per year for 2 years or 3% for the 2 years, or how to clarify that just a bit. Okay. For me.
Mr. Larson.
Mr. Chair, Representative Olson, the 3% would have been for each year, and the 3% would have been based on their previous biennial late costs. So you take your previous biennial costs, project 3% increases each year, and that's how we started out. Now, there was no new money coming, but just because there's no new money, we still have to negotiate, and we have to negotiate in good faith. And so that was our target when we sent the budget instructions out. Now, what did we anticipate when we sent that out? We anticipated that we would have increased would have anticipated would have been premium increases. We would have factored in the step increases. The step increases alone both years would have been about $20 million. We would have also factored in an across-the-board increase, wages, and so on. And all of that was projected last fall before we had the housing collapse and everything. And so all that money, while they did project it, was never appropriated, and then ultimately they were cut from that.
Okay. So Mr. Chair, then Mr. Larson, what you are saying is that these contracts represent a lower impact than what the assumptions were made in the original budgeting process.
Mr. Larson.
Yeah, Madam Chair, Mr. Chair, Senator Olson, significantly lower.
Okay.
Significantly lower.
Okay. Thank you.
Okay.
Representative Lanning.
Thank you, Mr. Chairman. Mr. Larson, you indicated that 98% of the employees qualify for the step increase, meaning only a couple percent are not providing satisfactory performance. What percent of employees currently are still eligible for step increases? The majority, or you have some kind of estimate as to how many employees are still eligible at this point?
Yes. Mr. Larson.
Mr. Chair, Representative Lanning, yes, I do have that, and I'm about to give you the demographics of each one of the units, and I have all of that broken down, and I'm prepared to give that to you.
Thank you.
The demographics of the settlements that we have before you today, just to give you a little background, Unit 2 is our craft, maintenance, and labor unit. Those are our skilled trade employees. Our bargaining units are large occupational units, and they cross state agencies. For example, the craft maintenance and labor unit is all of the skilled trades, and regardless of what agency they're in. Unit 3 is our service unit, which is our food service workers, groundskeepers, parks workers, and so on. Unit 4 is our human service technicians, is our healthcare non-professional, and we have our human service technicians, which comprises a significant size to that unit. Unit 6 is our clerical unit, which is synonymous of the term. It's typically our office support workers. Unit 7 is our technical unit, and those are our highway technicians, our natural resources technicians, zookeepers, and so on. Unit 8 is our correctional officer unit, and they provide the security services in our, I believe we have 9 correctional facilities. Then we have Unit 25, which is our radio communications operators, and those are housed at public safety, and they provide the radio dispatch for the state patrol, the enforcement officers for the Department of Natural Resources, the Bureau of Criminal Apprehension, and they also handle the state's 911 emergency services. The complexity of this bargaining is huge. There are about 35 articles to each one of these labor agreements. And the other thing to share with you is they're very mature contracts. These contracts are 35 years old, and so there's not a lot of major changes that would occur in this. We still have a 40-hour work week. We have 11 holidays, and so we're a very mature agreement. And so what we're really doing now is we end up negotiating primarily in the area of insurance and wages. But we do have certain issues that arise in the bargaining process. Some safety issues came up, and we've referred them to a statewide safety committee. And similar to what Mr. Morocco described about what our commitments were for the next 2 years, we've established certain committees to talk about some of the things that were brought up to the table. It's also, I believe, important to share with you that in my position, I want to make sure that we maintain our reasonable set of management rights so that we can operate in our organization and deliver the services that were statutorily required. Now, moving to the actual costs and the demographics, the AFSCME settlement, which is for the units 2, 3, 4, and 6, and 7, we have 12,250 full-time employees, 3,900 part-time employees. The average salary for this unit is, annual salary is $39,317. That does not include roll-ups. If you add roll-ups, which is FICA, MSRS, the others, you can add about another 15% to that number. 50%, in response to Mr. Lanning's question, 50% of the AFSCME employees are at the top of the pay scale. So for those 50%, they will not be eligible for that step increase. The average step size for this unit is 2.7%. What we have is we have the zero across-the-board increase. We have the steps in the second year for the people that are not at the top. We continued the deferred comp payment each year for this unit, and the deferred comp match that the employer matches. If the employee puts money into deferred comp, we match that up to $175, and we continued that for both years of the agreement. The Unit 8 contract, which is the correctional officers, we have 1,900 employees in this unit. Of that unit, the average salary is $43,900. 25% of the employees are at the maximum of their salary range. 75% are not and will be eligible for that second year step. This settlement mirrors the AFSCME Council 5 main settlement, which was again zero both years, steps in the second year. We continued the deferred comp match, and that's at $175. For Unit 25, which was the radio communications operators, we have 66 employees that are in that bargaining unit. These are, as I said, housed at public safety. The average salary for that bargaining unit is $43,900. 47% of the employees are below the max and will be eligible for the steps, and 53% of the employees are at the salary max and are not eligible. This settlement mirrors the others that I've just described, and it also provides for a $175 deferred comp match. The step size for this unit is 2.7%. Our professional unit, MAPE, has 12,500 employees, of which the average salary for the MAPE represented employees is $57,800. 44% are at their range max, and 56% of the employees are below the range max. This settlement mirrors the others. Again, no across-the-board increase either year. It does provide for the step increase in the second year. Their deferred comp match is $100, and the average step size for the MAPE-represented employees is 3.6%. Middle management, there are 2,850 full-time employees in this unit. The average salary for middle management is $69,200. 64% are at the max. 36 are below the max. This settlement mirrors the others that are before you that we've negotiated, which is, again, zero both years, steps in the second year. Their step size is 3.6%, and their deferred comp match is $300. And that is, I think, just a couple of points to share that this is the first time since the early 70s that we've brought the labor agreements to this group for your interim approval. And this is a real refreshing approach to be able to be here at this time instead of dragging the bargaining process out into the late summer and fall. And we're very happy that we were able to do this. And that concludes my presentation.
Thank you, Mr. Larson. I think that shows a lot of good work by you and obviously shows a lot of respect to the working groups, the MAPE and AFSCME members that are willing to work together with you. So thank you for that. Representative Hillstrom.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. Now getting back to my other questions, I think it's great that these contracts are here. So my question is, which contracts are not yet settled, and then do we have a timeline or a status on those contracts?
We have.
Mr. Larson.
We have reached a voluntary settlement with one unit so far out in the last couple of weeks. We reached a voluntary settlement with our group called State Residential Schools Education Association, or commonly referred to as SRSEA. There are teachers who teach at the Purpich Arts School, the Faribault Academies. I believe we also have teachers at the Department of Corrections and Human Services. I'm pleased to announce that we reached a voluntary settlement with them just a couple of weeks. They're going through their ratification process, and that settlement mirrors what we've just provided for you today. That brings us then to three other bargaining units. That's the law enforcement union and the nurses association and the engineers unit. Those three units are still out there. We do have, we're still working. The Nurses Association is meeting this afternoon at the Bureau of Mediation Services. I have a bargaining session scheduled tomorrow with the law enforcement unit. The engineers have refused our offer, and we have actually filed to go to interest arbitration.
Representative Hillstrom.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. I realize that this has been a really difficult time to bargain for all parties and that everyone has had to sacrifice in reaching these settlements. And, you know, I just want to encourage everyone to keep talking. And I'm pleased that you have these agreements before us, and hopefully we'll have additional agreements before the next session.
Mr. Larson, is that agreed?
Well,
okay.
Thank you.
Thank you, Mr. Larson. Given that, is there any questions to the presentation? If not, I'd be open to approval of resolution.
So moved, Mr. Chair.
Representative Hillstrom has moved. SER-1. Any questions in regards to that?
Can I bum your pen?
Representative Lanning.
Thank you, Mr. Chairman. I had a question about this diagram. Is it appropriate to ask that now? Or?
Sure, let's. Representative Lanning.
Thank you, Mr. Chairman. I'm not sure. It doesn't indicate who, where this comes from, but my question is on the 10-11 cost in the biennium versus cost impact on the next biennium. I would assume that the cost of the next biennium does not include any insurance costs. I mean, if we were to be in the same position we are now with no increase in insurance costs to the employees, that the cost in the next biennium would be a whole lot higher than what it is here if the state had to pick up that additional cost. Could someone address this? And
Mr. Lanning, that was made by Mr. Hubinger here, but I don't know if he'd like to comment or Mr. Larson.
Mr. Chair, I'm Representative Lanning. I'll talk about the graph, and then perhaps the question about the impact of insurance on the next biennium might be better responded to by Mr. Larson. This graph just captures the numbers from the settlement sheet that you see at the end of your summary of the summary of the contracts and plans, and shows in the darker bar the cost impact of various contracts in the current biennium that they were negotiated, and then the lighter gray is the impact on the next biennium, and shows generally. I wanted to show the history or the tradition or the pattern in the last 10 years, and indicates that the settlements that are being proposed here are significantly less than any other contracts or plans that we've considered in the last 10 years.
Mm-hmm.
This does pick up the projected cost of the insurance that's been negotiated in these contracts. Mm-hmm. It does not capture the 16% that would be projected in the next, in FY, or calendar year 12.
Representative Lanning.
Thank you, Mr. Chairman. Yeah, that's what I wanted clarified, that's not reflected here. And so, obviously, the real costs of the next biennium are really unknown at this point, depending on where we end up with the negotiations for the next biennium. But this is helpful. Thank you for this chart. But I wanted to see that particular point clarified. Thank you.
Thank you, Representative Lanning. Good work, Mr. Hubinger. Any further questions? Back to the motion. All in favor, say aye.
Aye. Aye.
Those opposed? It's been moved and approved. On to, thank you, Mr. Larson and Mr. Hansen.
Mr. Chair.
Representative Drazkowski.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. Would it be appropriate to ask a question that really of any of the presenters that are still here? I just have a quick question. The packet on insurance that was put together quickly, and I don't know if Mr. Morocco is still here or if someone else can answer it. Page 7 talks about a collaborative work group on that is going to be meeting over the next, I'm assuming, year or so. And the first bullet there suggests that it will look at the agreement's definition of dependence. I'd just be curious about some explanation about what that means. If
Mr. Morocco, would you be, looks like you're on your way. Thank you.
Mr. Chair and Representative Drazkowski, essentially the states for fully insured populations, this is outside of the SIGA plan, has many things that are mandated on state programs. So if you're a small employer, it's a fully insured product, the state is going to have some minimum components to what that product needs to look like. As part of our charter, we're required to follow state mandates in most circumstances. And so what we have is a discrepancy between what the unions have bargained and what the state for other kinds of programs has mandated in terms of what is a dependent. So as an example, a state mandate might require certain relationships like stepchildren or grandchildren to work in a certain way. They may need, I can give you one example. We allow grandchildren to be covered regardless of the age of the grandchild. So if you were to start covering a grandchild at age 5, we would allow that to happen as long as they were living with you. However, the state mandate says that grandchild has to live with you from the time of birth. And so it would be minor discrepancies like that we just want to clean up. We need to decide really, you know, whether we should be following the bargaining agreements or whether we should be looking at the state requirements for that. Does that answer your question?
Representative Drazkowski.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. Mr. Morocco, I believe it does. So there's nothing, no discussion about domestic partner benefits or any of those types of changes or alternate looks at how this could work.
Mr. Morocco.
Mr. Chair and Representative Drzkowski, not at this time. We'll simply be looking at what is currently available out there in the state mandates. Domestic partners in particular was something that was discussed as part of the bargaining process, but the unions had dropped it early on in an effort to move the bargaining process along.
Thank you.
Mr. Chairman.
Senator Scheid.
Mr. Chairman, for Mr. Morocco, I'm sorry.
Mr. Morocco.
Yeah,
almost made it.
He has the most interesting
almost.
Piece of all of this. Let's see, what was my...
Sorry.
Yes, I wanted... Thank you. Fortunately, I had shared with Senator Olson what I wanted to ask you about.
And I remembered.
I need somebody to follow me around. Mr. Morocco, do you... have you had any conversations about such things as autism? I suspect it's come up in the plans in any case, because I think some of the health plans do cover it, some or at least one of them does. And are you going to be talking about that kind of thing as well?
Mr. Morocco.
Mr. Chair and Senator Scheid, that's not something we typically talk about as part of the bargaining process. However, because we do respond to fiscal notes, I get involved from that perspective. And so I in the case of autism in particular, typically what I'll present is just whether there's a cost savings or a cost increase to the program, and obviously leave it, you know, the policy decisions up to folks like you. So I get involved personally, and the program gets involved in that sense, but it's not necessarily from a bargaining perspective that we would enter into those kinds of discussions.
But, Senator Scheid.
But Mr. Chairman, Mr. Morocco, the deal with this is that some of the CGIP plans cover it and some don't. For as particularly the, I think it's adaptive, behavioral analysis, the ABA piece, and I think the Blues, I think they cover it. And so if you're in the state plan and that's your health plan, the Blues, then you have that coverage, but the others you may or may not. And I just thought it might be helpful for you. I understand it's not a mandate, so you can't really speak to that. And there might be other things as well that a plan may one plan may cover that others don't, but within the CGIP, then different state employees have different kinds of coverage. I guess that's my point.
Mr. Morocco.
Yeah, Mr. Chair and Senator Scheid, you're absolutely right. What we typically avoid, and I avoid, is that I don't necessarily want to be, or the program doesn't want to be in a position of selecting certain kinds of conditions to be covered or not to be covered, much in the same way that we wouldn't. We really want to leave that kind of information up to the experts. And so because each health plan has a host of folks that they can tap into, medical directors, people who understand really what's the best technology out there, what are the best drugs, they can make that efficacy decision about what should and shouldn't be covered. And so largely the way our contracts are written to say that if you would cover it for your book of business, then you need to cover it for us. And if you wouldn't, then don't. And that sort of then keeps us really in line with where the general market trend is going in terms of coverage. It's unfortunate that in some of the specific cases that you referenced, oftentimes those decisions have been based on lawsuits, which is the reason why in the case of autism, you would see Blue Cross covering it and not the other health plans.
Thank you.
Senator Olson.
Mr. Chair, Mr. Morocco, what tier are the Blues?
Mr. Chair and Senator Olson, actually, all the plans would cover the spectrum of 1 through 1, 2, 3, or 4. It's really the individual clinics that are rated and are analyzed, not the plans themselves.
All right. Thank you.
Since you're here, can you give a 2-second commercial on those cards and why we did them and why we might want to use them? Because I find them very helpful, and
sure.
Maybe my
chair, are you confessing that there's more people that didn't admit
other
that they
no I just I just heard someone say that they don't use it and I think there's some advantages of why you might want to use them, because
sure.
You're trying to encourage doctor visits for checkups and sure. Manage care, and then but anyways, I'm just maybe why my fishing buddy might want to use it.
Mr. Chair, I'd be happy to do so. There's a couple key points to them. One, just from a program perspective and a usage perspective, I think they're a great a system that employees can use, again, to coordinate their flexible spending accounts, their health reimbursement arrangements, and now as we get into HSAs, so that when you go and you are presented with a cost, let's say it's a copay, a traditional FSA plan would require you to pay that copay, take the receipt, submit that receipt to the FSA vendor, and then be reimbursed. With the debit card, you simply are presented with that $20 copay. You swipe the card as though you're charging it, so to speak, and that $20 is covered. And there's no additional, in most cases, there's no additional paperwork needed. So there really shouldn't be a time in which you have any out-of-pocket dollars out there while you're waiting for the whole receipt and claims adjudication process to keep up. And again, it allows you, because the FSA dollars are use it or lose it, and the HRA dollars can be rolled over from year to year, it allows you to coordinate those dollars best so that we will tap the FSA dollars first because you have the most potential to lose those. And once those dollars are then expired, we will then start to use some of the HRA dollars. So certainly there's a huge convenience factor here. I think the second point that I would raise is that because it increases and I think improves on the convenience, hopefully our members will see that this is really a great product to use, and they will start electing more dollars in their FSA accounts. That has two impacts. One is that it lowers the taxable income of our members. I think that's great. It also lowers the tax requirements for the state because the state doesn't pay any FICA or other kinds of taxes on those dollars as well. So there really is a win-win there. Lastly, what I would say is that the reason we've used them is really as a reward, as I mentioned, back to the members. Our members really are using the program the way that we ask them, so that when we are in a situation where we do have surplus, we have an opportunity to reward our members for selecting those care systems that really are providing outstanding care, and it's a way for us to share that reward both with the members as well as the state.
Thank you, Mr. Morocco. I was just in a moment of self-disclosure. I plan to use my card when I go visit my Republican friend, Mr. Abler, up in Anoka for my adjustment. So hopefully he doesn't hurt me. No, so far, a funny thing is he says I lean to the left. I know that'll come as a surprise to you over there. But
well, Mr. Chairman, maybe he will straighten you out.
He's been working on that, and I'll use my card. Okay. Senator Olson.
Mr. Chairman, I have been using mine. At what point does the same company that manages our pre-tax benefit also manage the $250, whatever we called it now? Because it didn't seem to me in my statement that it reflected that. It was reflecting what I had put aside. So if I just kept using it, that would get reported then too?
Mr. Chair and Senator Olson, yes, it would be the same vendor that's managing the accounts. The actual card process itself is something that the vendor outsources. And so that is a different company. But in terms of managing the actual balances and the use of the card, that would all be through Ide Bailey, who is our FSA and HRA and debit card administrator.
Okay. Thank you.
Representative Begum.
Thanks. For the record, I do use the red cards, and I find them very easy to use. My question is, how can we still get these things in the mail that say this is not a bill? I thought we had taken care of that in the reform package that we passed 2 years ago, or last year, I mean.
Mr. Morocco.
Mr. Chair and Representative Bigham, I'm not aware of anything specifically in the reform that stopped the usage. What you're referring to is the explanation of benefits, which is something that still is required to be prepared. What an individual member has the choice in is whether or not you want to receive that electronically or through the mail. And so if you're a Health Partners member or a Blue Cross member, you can certainly make that request with them. But if there is something specific, I guess I would be happy to take a look at that if you have language. But I don't recall anything specifically related to EOBs.
Representative Bingham.
Okay, well, maybe that'll be a nice bill for next year, but maybe we just didn't include the state plan in it. Sometimes that does, that has been known to happen, where, you know, some of the other insurance companies are required to do stuff, but the state mm-hmm. plans are, because we're self-insured, mm-hmm. are exempted out of it. But it is, I think, something to look into. One, they're annoying. Two, I think they're wasteful on money. And with the electronic age and the internet, I'm not sure why we couldn't have some sort of portal that we couldn't go look up our benefits if we had any particular question on it. So if there isn't plans to do that, I would be looking into doing that next year.
Thank you, Ms. Rocco. Go ahead and run. Ms. Dresbeck. Good morning. Thank you for your patience. And,
good morning.
Go ahead when you're ready.
Mr. Chair and members of the subcommittee, my name is Mary Lou Dresbach. I'm the Director of Human Resources at the Office of Higher Education. I want to thank you for the opportunity this morning to present the Office of Higher Education Unclassified Compensation Plan for fiscal years 2010 and 2011. This plan covers approximately 45 professional staff at our agency, and the plan has been reviewed and approved by the Minnesota Department of Management and Budget. I'll outline the key provisions of our plan to you, and then if you have questions, I'll certainly make every effort to answer them. For the fiscal 2010 and 2011 biennium, there are no general or across-the-board increases for staff that are covered under this plan. Also, in the first year of the biennium, there is no provision for performance-based increases to be granted during the first year of the biennium, and the possibility for those staff effective January 5th of 2011 who are eligible to receive some kind of performance-based increase, meaning that they're not at the top of their salary range. They would be eligible to receive that, and that's calculated on an aggregate of 3.5% of all eligible employees. Now, the appointing authority, the head of our agency, may withhold all or a portion of the performance-based increases or may delay the increases due to budgetary reasons. And in all actuality, the last two bienniums, even though there's been provision for a maximum of 3.5% aggregate, it's come in at about 2.9%. And also, not all of the eligible employees received a performance-based increase in either biennium. In both years of the biennium, there's also a provision for achievement awards, and these are up to $2,000, a lump sum amount. Employees must demonstrate outstanding performance to receive such awards. The awards are limited to 20% of the eligible employees in the plan, and the appointing authority may withhold all or a portion of these increases and may delay the increases due to budgetary reasons. And just for your information, in the past biennium or the current biennium, no achievement awards were granted. We just decided internally that for budgetary reasons, no achievement awards would be granted. There is a $300 annual matching contribution to an employee's deferred compensation account, and that continues for the next biennium, or an employee may convert 40 to 50 hours of vacation time to the deferred comp program, and that depends on the level of their classification. The insurance provisions are comparable to those in other bargaining units. In 2010 and 2011, the insurance plan remains the same as the insurance plan for 2009, and the state will provide 125 employer contribution to a health reimbursement account to all Advantage contract holders during the 2011 plan. As far as the cost of these changes, the Minnesota Department of Management and Budget estimates that the cost of the increases provided by this plan will be 0.86% for the 2010-2011 biennium, and there's a 2.7% cost increase from biennium to biennium. Minnesota Management and Budget indicated in their cost analysis that $26,000 of the $81,000 cost of this plan for the biennium results from the legislation that increases the employer and employee contributions to the MSRS general plan for employees' retirement. If you have any questions, I'd be happy to try to answer them for you.
Any questions? Thank you very much. Stick around. There might kind of seems to be the pattern that we have a couple maybe later. But
that's fine.
Thank you very much. Mr. Ishida?
All right, he didn't know about the red card either.
Thank you very much. I understand this is a big meeting for you and for us. Thank you very much for your years of service, and I understand this is your last meeting. We were kind of hoping it was Senator Metzen's last meeting, but...
Thank you, Mr. Chair. For the record, my name is Bill Cheat. I'm the Vice Chancellor of Human Resources for the Minnesota State Colleges and Universities. And yes, indeed, this is my last meeting with this august body. I've been attending these kinds of meetings for about 12 years and wrapping up about 36 and a half years of service to the state. So it's been, I might just say at this point, it has been a real pleasure working with this committee, particularly with Senator Scheid and Senator Metzen as they've chaired the committee in the past years. I've always found them very easy to work with and very concerned about the state employees. So,
well, thank you, sir, and thank you for your service to the state of Minnesota. And do you have to turn in your red card then? Or
I have to admit, Senator Metzen, I am actually behind you. I do have it in my office, and I am going to learn how to use it hopefully in the next couple of weeks. But my staff keeps telling me everything you heard today. It's a great deal, very convenient, and I should be doing it. So. I plan to get on that.
Thank you, sir.
I'm here today to present the personnel plan for Minnesota State College and University administrators. Greg Hubinger has done his usual fine job of summarizing the changes, but I just point out a couple of highlights. As with most of the plans that you've heard today, there is no across-the-board increases in this plan. There are no annual performance-based adjustments to base salaries. And even though it doesn't affect salaries directly, we have not proposed any increases to the salary ranges either. We have, as those of you who have been on the committee before know, that we do a very thorough job of analyzing our salary ranges to remain competitive with the market, and I think that has served the system well. But at this point, we're not coming in with any adjustments to the salary ranges. Again, for those of you who have been around, I do want to take this opportunity to point out that in 2010, 2011, you may have an issue with respect to that. August of 2011 is when the chancellor's employment agreement expires. I would expect that there'll be a chancellor's search in beginning in the fall of 10. We'll still be operating under these salary ranges, which were established in 2007. So I would anticipate that that market might be a little bit of an issue when you go to fill that position. And I'm sure it's something that can be worked through at that time. And I think it's a wise thing to wait because we don't know what the market salaries are going to look like over the next 2 years with the economic conditions. The rest of the plan changes were primarily editorial and clarification, and I'd be happy to answer any questions the committee might have.
Thank you, sir. Any questions? Thank you very much.
Thanks.
Mr. Larson? I understand you brought the commissioner with. Again, I understand they're working on questions upstairs. Should we go get a few of them just to practice up for tomorrow? Or
I'm not. I had good practice 2 weeks ago. Okay. I don't think I need more.
Mr. Larson.
Mr. Chair, for the record, my name is Paul Larson. I'm the state negotiator. I'm here to present the two pay plans that are before you, which is the commissioner's plan and the manager's plan for employees that are not represented by or assigned to a bargaining unit. A little bit about the demographics of the commissioners' plan, and I think it's important to point out that commissioners are not in this plan. I know there's been some confusion through the years, and I routinely do bring this up. It does not apply to agency heads. Their salary is based on statute. Chapter 15, I believe, addresses that. The agency heads are entitled to the benefits set on the insurance program of this, but other than that, it does not apply to them. The demographics of the commissioner's plan is primarily employees where by statute they are prohibited from being assigned to a bargaining unit. We have a definition of what we call confidential employee, and those are employees that typically are involved in the negotiations process, and by virtue of their confidentiality status, they are moved into the commissioner's plan as well. We have 1,125 full-time employees in the commissioner's plan. 126 are part-time. The average salary for this unit is $66,600. 59% of the employees are at the salary range maximum, and so that means 41 are still within the range. The agreement that we have here, or the plan, I should say, before you, provides for no across-the-board increase in either year. However, it does provide for a performance increase eligibility in the second year. And unlike the negotiated agreements, the performance increase in the commissioner's plan is totally discretionary on the agency. Then they can decide whether or not they're going to provide them or not. And so I want to emphasize they're totally discretionary on their part. It does provide for the continuation of a $300 match for deferred comp, or an option for the employee to be able to convert 40 hours of vacation to deferred comp, and that continues through the year as well. As the manager's plan, we have 1,277 employees that are assigned to the managerial plan. The average salary is $91,000 a year. 48% of those employees are at the range max. 52% are below. This, again, similar to the other agreements and plans that are before you, have no increase either year, no performance increase in the first year. However, there is the opportunity for a performance increase for these employees in the second year of the agreement, and again, I want to emphasize that those performance increases are totally discretionary on the agency. It also provides for the continuation of a $300 deferred comp match, and it also provides in this unit for a 50-hour vacation conversion to deferred comp. And I believe that constitutes my explanation. If there are any questions specific about the plans, I'd be happy to answer them.
Thank you, Mr. Larson. Any questions for Mr. Larson? Representative Drazkowski.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. Mr. Larson, I just ask, you've given us those demographics for each of these groups. Would you be able to send us a copy of those? I didn't write the numbers down, but it'd be good to have.
Mr. Larson.
Chair, Representative Drazkowski, sure. We could do that for you.
Thank you.
Put a narrative together.
Okay. Any questions? Seeing none, I'd entertain a motion on the SER-2.
I'd move that, Mr. Chairman.
Senator Scheid has moved. Any questions? Seeing none, all in favor say aye.
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 Those opposed? SER-2 is adopted and passed. Thank you, Mr. Larson and Commissioner. Thank you very much. Mr. Shida, thank you again for your service to the state of Minnesota, and thank you. Thank you to Mr. Huebinger and Ms. Kidd. Thank you for getting us organized, and Mr. Marks answering all the tough questions today. with that, I believe we're adjourned till well, we don't know. Call the chair, I guess. Thank you very much. Hope everybody has a nice summer.
It's like a third over.
Yeah.
Third over.
Yeah. Probably